Welcome to this edition of Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host for this episode, Dr. Mark Dubin from Baltimore, Maryland. Today, we will be discussing the article, Assessment of Conflicts of Interest in Literature on Monoclonal Antibodies for Chronic Rhinosinusitis with Nasal Polyposis using the Open Payments Database, which was published in September 2024. I'm joined by the senior author, Dr. Peter Manis from Yale University in beautiful New Haven. Welcome, Pete. Congratulations to you and your co-authors on the publication.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure, as always. I'd like to start off by disclosing that I have received consulting payments from Sanofi Regeneron in the last 3 to 15 months and comment that you appear to be a unicorn as a rhinologist who has not received a consulting payment from a pharmaceutical company that has monoclonal antibody indicated for CRS. With that said, to start, so that we're all on the same page, can you explain what constitutes a conflict of interest and why they're significant in medical research?
Well, first of all, let me say thank you for disclosing your conflict and the fact that I haven't received a consulting payment. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe they just don't want me. And, you know, now I'm feeling a little self-conscious about that. But nevertheless, when you start thinking about a conflict of interest, you know, that really occurs when someone's personal interests, family, friends, financial, social, could potentially compromise his or her judgment or decisions or actions. And I think the emphasis here really is on could. I personally would say that this rarely affects a person's judgment or actions in medical research, but it's important to make sure that others know about any potential conflicts of interest. They are certainly significant in medical research because we want to make sure that there are no questions regarding the validity of the research we do. Because, you know, we live in a time now where trust in science is questioned. So we want to make sure that our behaviors as researchers really are beyond reproach.
Thanks, Pete. So you talk about the Sunshine Act and the Open Payments Database. How has this changed the landscape of conflict reporting in medicine?
Well, you know, for a long time, the medical community really relied on a system of physician self-disclosure. And there were really no reciprocal requirements for companies that actually provided these payments. And that changed with the passage of the Physicians Payments Sunshine Act in 2010. This was a clear turning point in the regulation of financial disclosures for pharmaceutical companies and medical device companies. So the Sunshine Act basically mandated companies to report all payments to physicians and teaching hospitals. And then CMS established the Open Payments Database, OPD, in 2014. And that houses this industry reported payment information. It's certainly searchable. You can look up what you get. You can look up what I get. You can look up what your neighbor gets.
Got it. So you mentioned in the introduction that the relationship between the pharma industry and physicians has become more complex. How has that occurred over the last 30, 40 years?
There's just so much involvement. And there's also a variety of different forms that these relationships take place within. There's research money. There's consulting fees. There's dinners. I think there used to be trips to Aruba. I don't know. I think that predates me. But the point of it is really complex. It takes a lot of forms, and that can really complicate the disclosure process. And these relationships, they're not really easy to study. And it's difficult to assess, is there any implication of this on research and patient care?
I'll tell you personally, I really miss the pens. The pens are, the loss of pens is a big loss for me.
Yeah. This is a podcast, so nobody could see, but I'm holding up a terrible Papermate blue pen that's just, it doesn't do the job for me. I would like something with a, you know, Paxil on it or something like that.
Just went right to your drug cabinet, didn't you there, Pete?
That's right.
All right, moving on. So on to the actual article. So describe the methods of this review for our listeners.
Sure. So put simply, we used AI to make it easy. And if we start getting into the real depths of AI, we're going to need some 20-year-olds to come help us out that really understand this. But, you know, at its heart of hearts, what we did is, well, just think about it. If you could imagine cross-checking all of these conflicts of interest with the information in the Open Payments Database, it's very cumbersome. So utilizing AI and writing appropriate questions and loading in payment database and conflict of interest information from journals, AI did this so easily. But we had to make sure that it worked. So actually, prior to this study, we did a pilot study with similar data. But basically, what we did in that study is we took random selections of the data and we did cross-check this manually, which is very cumbersome, but we had to actually prove that it worked. And what we found was very high levels of accuracy when utilizing AI, when you compare it to actually manually cross-checking. So that validated our methods. Things like physician name or title, things like that, locations, 100% accurate. The hardest thing that it had a hard time with, and by say hardest, maybe we had about a 2% error rate. It usually centered around when physicians changed institutions in the midst of reporting versus publishing. It would get a little bit confused on that. But still there, we had over a 97% accuracy rate.
Right. And you focused in this article on general payments, which is, you know, basically excludes research. It's the meals, it's the honorarium, it's the consulting fees. Why did you choose this? I mean, there clearly is a large amount of money funneling through research as well.
Yeah, don't give away my future paper ideas right there yet, okay? we took general because general payments, because it really lends a broad scope to our analysis of industry financial relationships. It encompasses over a dozen subcategories. You mentioned some of them: consulting and speaking fees, honoraria, gifts, royalties, entertainment, travel, lodging, food, and beverage. Those are all under general payments, and they're not associated with research. So we thought that that was a pretty good broad base, which would at least give a sense of, you know, what are people disclosing?
Seems reasonable. So let's get to the meat of the matter now. Talk to me about the rate of undisclosed and overdisclosed payments.
So if you look at some of our data, for example, there were 30 publications that received relevant payments. And of those, 21 had some conflicts of interest that were undisclosed. That's 70%. When you looked at unique authors receiving relevant payments, there were 56 unique authors receiving relevant payments. 40 of those had some areas of non-disclosure. That's about 71%. And so that right there is interesting. Now, again, I just want to be very clear. We're not sitting here assigning blame. We're not sitting here necessarily people are doing something wrong. There were some errors in this. And we also have to consider the open payments database itself and the accuracy of that. And we can talk about that a little bit later, but I think that there's some questions that at least we bring up in our limitations.
Fair. I have to ask, were there some serial offenders? I don't want names, just sort of yes, no. You didn't comment, you know, in the article.
Yes, and I have no further comment, Senator.
Fair. I had to ask the question. So overreporting of conflicts was also fascinating, something I honestly wouldn't have thought about. Tell me, you know, a little bit about the overreporting and why you think that this might be the case.
So I think there's one kind of practical reason, and there may be one sort of more global reason. So it's possible that long publication timeframes, like 15 months and greater, might have contributed to articles that had conflict of interest disclosures, but didn't have corresponding payments that we found. That's sort of the more logical one. The other one is, I think a lot of times we usually don't fully remember things that are considered a conflict. You know, for example, did I go to a lunch symposium at a meeting that was sponsored by a company? And because we often don't keep track of some of these things, it kind of speaks to a second point, which is that I really do think a lot of people are very hyper aware and very vigilant regarding any potential conflicts and then report them as such, even if they're unsure.
Yeah. And then you mentioned that smaller payments were much more frequently undisclosed to, compared to larger ones, with only 17.6% of the payments that were not reported being over $10,000. That being said, 17.6% of payments being over $10,000 is a significant amount of underreporting. I mean, you sort of kind of looked at it the other way. I subtracted it. You know, it's hard to forget a $10,000 payment. as well, or should be anyway.
It would be in my house, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And then again, most people are doing the right thing, but there are clearly some lapses, you know, in the reporting. Because I will flip the numbers and point out that 17.6% were some pretty big payments.
It's very true. Very true. And I think, again, you know, it gets to some of the challenges in just monitoring your conflicts of interest, some of the problems with the reporting structures that we currently have. And then, I mean, think about it. How busy were you today? How busy was I today? And did you get an email that asked you to fill something out? And you might have done that pretty quick to get it done. So there is some human error that can certainly happen with this stuff.
Yeah, and you mentioned a lot of, there's timing errors, you know, the length of publication, something may have occurred, you know, in the interval between submission and publication. You know, there's not uniformity in the way that conflicts are reported to journals. Some require everybody doing it individually, which I would imagine would be more accurate than the senior author or corresponding author being responsible for, you know, everybody's conflicts in general. But overall, this obviously does have implications for, you know, research integrity and public trust. I mean, what are your thoughts about your results and how they could translate into kind of real world implications?
Yeah, I mean, the potential implications for this were really, that was a big consideration in even looking at this. And again, let me say, I really think that the vast majority of researchers really go out of their way to do the right thing. And I also think that the vast majority of researchers will always act in a way to make sure that there's no bias in their work, no matter if there's conflicts or not. And then remember, the presence of a conflict of interest does not mean then that there is bias. But to your point, from the outside looking in, any perceived conflict of interest can be looked at by the public as skewed to favor industry. And we really have to try and be as careful as possible. And to use a phrase I mentioned earlier, to be beyond reproach. That's actually why I'm encouraged by some of the over-reporting that we had discussed earlier.
That's a good point. So, you know, taking a step back, what can the research community do to implement and make this reporting more uniform? Is it penalties for not reporting? Is it using AI across, you know, in all its power and wisdom, you know, to monitor this? You know, how could we use this data as a lesson and make us all better?
Well, I think you talked about it earlier. One of the issues is the different reporting requirements that journals have. Some people have an author do it individually, which I agree that that's likely more accurate as opposed to the senior author trying to collect everybody and herding the cats to try and get people's disclosures in. You know, one possible way is to have a standard adoption of a universal conflict of interest disclosure policy amongst journals. Now, I mean, these are all human beings and they're adults and a lot of them are physicians. And if you ever get five physicians in a room, you're probably not going to get any agreement. But what you could do is you could say, look, you're not going to be indexed on PubMed if you don't use this disclosure system. And you could make it something like that. That's just kind of blanket. You know, in terms of penalties and things like that, I really do think that the vast majority of people, these are errors. But you can figure out the folks, the repeat actors that you could, you know, the repeat offenders. And, you know, if somebody keeps doing it over and over and over again and they have significant payments, I mean, maybe that's a time to restrict publishing opportunities in journals. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know if any of that's legal or anything. But again, I think you're talking about the one or two people as opposed to the majority.
Fair. So in closing, I want to note that I started this podcast by acknowledging that I've received consulting payments from one of these pharmaceutical companies. And I made an offhand joke that you are one of the few rhinologists who have not. With that, there is an inordinate amount of money flowing into our field in the form of general payments, research payments, et cetera, in a way that we as a field have not seen in decades. You know, pharma has much deeper pockets than other, you know, device companies in general. That's clear. Obviously, the reason why you chose this as opposed to device funding. Do you have any comments on how this money, regardless of disclosure, may be affecting the integrity research in ENT and CRS in general?
Well, just for full disclosure, you know, I was involved in a research study on biologics with GSK at one point.
So that's why you didn't look into the research funding. That's why you looked into general payments.
Well, what I didn't want to show was that I think I'm the only researcher in that who actually lost money on the thing. So, you know, it's the, but, you know, in terms of affecting the integrity of research, again, I am unfortunately an optimist. And knowing our colleagues, I do tend to give people the benefit of the doubt that they're acting with the highest levels of integrity. I mean, I would have to see evidence that completely contradicted that before I would make any statements regarding a lack of integrity in research. I think the, you know, we are all hypercritical of other people's work. And every author has their reputation on the line when they publish something. I don't think most of them are going to throw that away for $10,000, for $20,000. But you know what? If they do, we're going to be able to identify it because we look at the papers, we look at the data, we know what it says. And if something stinks, somebody's going to say something about it.
No, I agree 100%. And I appreciate you looking into this. And I was, you know, despite the high percentage of misfiled conflicts, I would say, the amounts that were undisclosed, you know, were small for the vast majority of people. And it was encouraging to see. Thanks for joining me, Pete. This was a great discussion.
No, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And again, congratulations to you and your colleagues on your publication. And thank you, of course, to our Scope It Out listeners. This is Mark Dubin for Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology, signing off for now.